Hello and welcome to the 14th episode of the Derailed Podcast. I am Chris.
And I'm Fred.
And welcome, guys. So traditionally, we start the show off talking about emails and social and all that kind of stuff. But I was just saying to Fred, I've kind of been dropping the ball on that recently. Things have been a little bit haywire. We got some really, really awesome emails though. So I think I'm going to do a big bumper email discussion next week. And I'm going to reply to everyone individually during the week as well. But thanks so much for your emails, guys. I can tell you I've read all of them. I just haven't had a chance to reply yet. But yeah, very awesome. People from all over the world, which is always really exciting.
Yeah,
especially for us in South Africa, kind of the arse end of nowhere. So it's always pretty exciting to get emails from countries all over the world.
Yes.
Pretty, pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I'll definitely be replying to everyone and just want to say thank you guys so much. I'm sorry that I haven't read your names or responded to you in the show, but we'll get there.
We will, yeah.
We will get there. Yeah. Anything on Instagram, Fred? You're the Instagram guy?
No real discussion on Instagram, just a couple of likes. Whenever I remember to take a photo of a game we play, then I post it when the next episode comes out, but I don't always remember, so.
Yeah, we've been bad at that recently. We've actually been getting some plays in. We've been getting quite a few plays in. Basically like an 1889 obsession at the moment. I think we discussed that last week. Yeah, we've been playing a lot of 89 and we've been playing our 1830 game online.
Yes.
So actually it's worth revisiting because last week I was talking about this idea of net worth and I was like, at what point does it kind of become like set in stone almost? And I don't exactly know what happened, but my net worth is now second. From being like pretty severely second last, it's now second.
Yes.
There's still a pretty big gap between me and number one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're pretty close to each other. But I thought that was kind of interesting. And that happened before you dumped your crappy company on me that I now have to deal with.
It's not that crappy. It's manageable.
Well, there's an interesting situation in this game at the moment in terms of now that we actually understand how the train locking stuff works. In that when you have two trains, and a five train has been bought, you can't buy anything else. And it becomes tricky even to transfer trains between companies. So if you have two companies and they both have a three and a four train, the six will rest the threes, but you can't buy the six.
Yes, that company can't buy the six, yeah.
What I've noticed that's interesting is that there's one player who has a huge amount of company cash, enough to buy a six, but the company that has the six
has the money for the six.
The money for the six.
Yeah, has two trains already.
But it becomes very difficult for him to transfer the money to his other companies. So let's say the other company buys, I don't know, he's going to have to buy one of his crappy trains with his other company and then use the money to buy the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's difficult to make space.
Yeah, no, but it can be done. I mean, he's president of three companies, I think. So
right.
One of his other companies just has to buy a train.
Is he on three now?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, I thought he was on two. Oh, yeah, he is on three. You're right. So he can do it, yeah. But it's quite interesting when you're in that situation where you have like a four and a three. And a lot of companies have kind of a four and a three. And so you might want to buy the six before you get trapped into buying a diesel or something.
Yeah.
But you can't.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something that I've been taking into account more in our games, is that you want to be careful about getting stuck with, especially when you get to the two trains, that's when it becomes tricky.
Yeah.
If you have a three and a four, you are going to get stuck unless you buy one of the fives, essentially.
Yes.
But you're not going to be able to buy a six. You're not going to be able to buy a diesel.
Yeah.
But by the time the six comes, you'll lose your three. But if you have two fours, then you're really stuck.
Yeah.
And that happened to one of us the other day. I don't know if it was actually me, but one of us had two fours. And then you can't, it becomes very tricky. Although I suppose with a four, you can upgrade it into a diesel if no one buys the diesel first. So maybe that's a little bit of a way you can get around that if you have the diesel upgrade thing.
Right.
Yeah, because that's the scenario in which you can do it.
Okay.
But yeah, it becomes pretty tricky when you want to juggle trains between companies, but you train locked at two on both your companies. So you're like, I just want to make space for this and you can't. Or you want to dump a company, but you can't transfer the one train across because the train limit has become much trickier. And I think it's partly because we misunderstood the rule for quite a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's become a much more significant thing in our games, and I feel like something that I have to give a lot of thought to as well in terms of managing that. Am I going to get stuck with these crappy trains and then everyone rushes through the fives and the sixes and I'm on the hook for a diesel or something like that? Because the jump there is pretty huge, right? And I think that's what makes it scary. So oftentimes there's sort of two or three five trains and then usually like two, six trains, and then you're in diesels.
Yes. And if you can't upgrade to a diesel, if you have to outright buy it, it is very expensive.
Yeah, that is brutal.
Yeah.
1100, I think, in 89 cost to outright buy that, which can bankrupt you basically if you're not careful. So where that becomes really, really tricky though is that because there's so few brown trains before you get to the diesels, if you don't put yourself in a position where you can buy the 5 or buy the 6, other people can easily snap that up in front of you.
Yeah,
a lot to think about.
There is, but
that train thing is very precarious in our games. And I think the other thing that's interesting is that the one player who can buy a 6 right now comfortably doesn't really want to, because he's got 3 companies with 3 trains.
Yes, all of his companies have at least 1 3 train now.
Yeah, and I think a couple of them only have like 1 3 train or something like that. Like he's going to be on the hook for quite a lot of trains. So
No, but he can do it.
Yeah, he can do it. It's just a bit precarious. But he has to basically buy 2 trains.
I think it's going to happen in this set of ORs, which is why I got rid of Eerie. I'm shuffled my trains around so that my one company has a 5 and a 4 and Eerie has a 3, which you inherited now. So
yeah, I'm hopeful that I can stay afloat with that.
No, you'll be fine. You've got a company with 2 trains in it, I think. So
yeah,
you'll be fine.
Depends how quickly we burn through the get into diesels and stuff like that.
Yes,
because once the first 6 train is bought, you can buy a diesel.
Right. Yeah.
Scary times.
And then the 4s go away, right?
Yes, and then the 4s go away.
Well, I've got a 5 at least, so.
Yeah. I've got a 5 in my one company, which is okay. It's just the Eerie nonsense that.
I'm sure you'll find a way. Your net worth is more than mine.
Yeah, after all. Exactly. That's all that matters. Let's just remember the snapshot in time. If I go bankrupt, just remember I was ahead at this point.
Yeah, but I really don't think the net worth means too much until permanent trains are settled everywhere. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we did get in a play of, and we were almost like debating whether to even talk about this, but a couple of people have asked me about it, is City of the Big Shoulders.
Oh, yes.
Which is the like 18XX Euro kind of thing.
Mm.
I got a little bit of like buzz amongst the 18XX crowd because it was kind of billed as like quite heavily 18XX influenced.
Right.
To the point in, I think it's Italy. Is it Italy where it originally comes from? I could have that wrong.
I don't know.
But there it's actually called like Chicago 1875 or something like that. It actually has an 18XX-y kind of name.
I think this one does as well. It's just at the end or something, so or like a subtitle.
Yeah,
or something.
So the reason it has, like, I think in like the North America release, it's just called City of the Big Shoulders, but over there it's called like Chicago 18 whatever City of the Big Shoulders. I don't know. It's this weird thing where the publisher has different names depending on
the region.
Okay. Yeah, but I was pretty disappointed in it in terms of 18XX-ness. So it basically, to tell you guys a little bit about it, it sort of lifted the stock market pretty much wholesale in terms of how that works. A lot of ways quite similar to the 46 stock market in terms of there being like double jumps and triple jumps and things like that. In terms of it being 1D, so it's just straight up and down. The only thing that's significantly different from 46 is that if you sell multiple shares, you drop multiple times instead of just once.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff. So they kind of just ripped out the whole stock market. But it felt like all the other changes they made kind of made it very uninteresting. So for like example, the game lasts a fixed 5 rounds. And that kind of ruins a lot of stuff. There's not really much room for maneuvering. You can withhold, for example, or pay dividends. That stuff stays the same. But you never are ever going to withhold. If you've only got 5... So 5 rounds doesn't... There's not like multiple ORs per round.
Yeah.
It's 1 OR. So you're getting 5 ORs in the entire game,
basically.
And when you only have 5 ORs, you're just paying dividends every time.
Yeah.
Money's never an issue. There's no train rusting. There's no trains at all.
Yeah.
You run like companies, which is pretty cool, but there's nothing that becomes obsoleted.
Yes. Yeah.
So you kind of just run your company, it ramps up, you buy new stuff for it, you're never really in danger of anything. So for that, you can dump a company, but you don't really ever have a reason to. You could to potentially get into something new, but it takes time to build infrastructure, basically, in a company. And that means that you don't really want to dump it because starting up a new company, you sort of have limited time to get its infrastructure and stuff going because you have limited actions. It's possible. But on top of all of this, the president shares 30%, not 20%, which makes it really hard to dump your company.
Yeah.
It's incremental cap, basically. Yeah, it just... It was kind of a cool idea, but it just had some very, very rough edges. And in the beginning, I really liked it. And then towards the end, I was like, I don't know if I do like this. Because in the beginning, it was cool and the stock market was interesting. But as the game goes on, it kind of drags out and it becomes very boring. Like, I found myself wanting to do stuff. I wanted to float a new company. I wanted to sort of sell down this one. So you can't do any of that stuff. You can't, like in a full cap game or a lot of 18xx games, you'll kind of sell down a company once you've sort of expended its resources and then float a new one kind of thing. But there was none of that really in this. Because the present share was 30%, it was too much. You were injuring yourself too much to do that. You only have 5 rounds, so you can't really like get into something new. You never really were running out of resources. I don't know. There was just so many stuff built around the system that kind of made the system less interesting.
Yeah. I think what you pointed out during our play as well was a very good point, is like you're not really involved in other people's turns. You float a corporation or a company. And instead of trains, you buy factories. So each company has, almost like you have home stations, you have a set number of factories that each company can run. And the factories require resources, and then they produce goods or something that you can then sell to the market, right? So that is kind of like, instead of running routes, you're selling goods. Instead of buying trains, you're buying factories and resources. But the thing is, because there's no like the track laying thing, track laying in 18xx affects other people.
Yeah.
And stations affect other people because they block routes. There's none of that in this game. Like, all the corporations are self-contained completely. They have their own little factories. They have their own little resources. They produce goods. They sell those goods. That doesn't really affect. I mean, selling goods can affect the market price for the goods a little bit and things like that. So your point was that you really actually don't care what other people are doing on their turn. So when it's not your turn, there's downtime that actually feels like downtime, where it doesn't in 18xx. But I actually really did like the factories, though. I thought they were very interesting. Kind of like a Oh My Goods kind of feeling, where you can chain within a corporation. If you have 2 or 3 factories in there, you can gain resources for the second one by running the first one. So you can kind of do nice daisy chaining kind of thing there, which is interesting. But yeah, but your point of the downtime was very valid, I think.
Yeah, it was brutal for me. That was the most egregious thing about the game for me, was just that downtime felt brutal.
Mm.
So yeah, like Fred says, there's no shared map.
Yeah.
So everything you do in terms of running your companies or running your routes as you would in 18xx, that all happens on your own individual player board.
Yes.
And so there's really no competition there. There's a worker placement kind of element that comes in. It's a separate kind of phase or whatever. And that has a lot of competition, but that's typical Euro stuff, like don't take my spot, I need that spot, competition for placement stuff, right? But in terms of the actual running of companies, yeah, you get to feel really clever because you kind of like produce these goods which feed the next company which do this, and it's quite cool and it's fun for you while you're doing it, but it's super boring for everyone else.
Yeah.
And it takes a long, long time.
Mm.
Like running those companies and figuring out all the resources and figuring out what you want to do takes a long time. This game took us a long time though. I don't know how long exactly. I want to say like 4 hours or something.
It was getting towards 4 hours, I'm sure. Yeah, it was long.
You could play a short 18xx easily. You could play an 89 in the same time it takes to play this game.
Yes.
And you will not spend half the time bored like I did. And I think that's why in the beginning I was really enjoying it. I was like, oh, this is cool. And like, oh, finally a Euro with an actual stock market. Mm. That's actually cool. And then the more I played it, the more I wanted to do 18xx-y stuff and I couldn't.
Mm.
And then the more bored I got, and then by the end, I actually just wanted it to be over.
Yes.
So I don't know if it would almost be better as a two-player game, just so that...
I think it might be better at two.
Just so there's less downtime, and you can kind of... Because it's quite... There's a lot of elements that are quite fun to it.
Yeah.
And I feel like if it was a much shorter experience, if there was much less downtime, it would be a fairly solid Euro.
Yes. There's potential for there to be competition in the resources that the factories need. But we played it at 4, and you just can't keep an eye on everyone and calculate, okay, he needs this, so if I take those, then they can't do that, because it's just too many people. But I think when you're playing two-player, that would be more of a factor. Like, running my company would be almost as good as denying your company from running, kind of thing, you know? So I definitely think it could be interesting at 2. The downtime wouldn't be as big of an issue at 2 either. So yeah, maybe it'll be good at two.
Yeah, but then I'm like, but you can play some 18xx's at two.
You can, yeah.
Fun. So I think that's where it becomes hard, is that I almost want to just say, just rather play a good 18xx, like a short playing 18xx. It's hard to look, I 100% do not recommend it if you're like an 18xx player who wants like a variation on 18xx. Mm. It's not that. You're not going to get an 18xx feel from it. I think you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
So if you're an 18xx specifically and that's what you want, just skip it.
Yeah.
If you like heavy Euros, to be honest, I still feel like there's better heavy Euros, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend in that vein either.
Yeah.
The downtime is too much.
And
yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I didn't love it. I didn't hate it, but...
I think I liked it a little bit more than you did. But yeah. I mean, your points are valid. And
you're better with downtime than me, though.
Yes. Like, yeah, I didn't mind it as much.
You've always been more okay with like long playing games. Like, you would play 7-player Caverna, and I would rather claw my eyes out with a spoon than do that.
I would happily play 7-player Caverna.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. So you don't mind that kind of stuff. I'm a little bit more impatient.
Yeah.
But that being said, yeah, just play 46 or 89 or Cologne. I don't know. Just play any of these 18xx's to play in a short amount of time and get the full fat experience.
Yeah.
It kind of felt like half heavy Euro and half 18xx, and I feel like it didn't do either great.
Yeah, I can definitely see where the 18xx inspiration comes in and what they were trying to do. And the stock market wasn't completely like useless. I did... at one point, just buy a share in Rudy's company and then sell it to drop his share price into the zone where he can only double his share price instead of triple it.
Yeah.
And I mean, that did affect his game for sure. So you can still do some interesting
things. We had some interesting stock rounds. Like, there was some interesting stuff. It just... Mm. The problem is it just sits in the shadow of 18xx, right? Yeah. And because it doesn't play in like 90 minutes or something, it sits in that shadow quite heavily because you're just like, but I could... be doing all of this, but more interesting version of this.
Yeah.
So that's where it kind of becomes tricky, I think.
Yeah.
You're right, though. The most interesting thing is the companies, because they're very asymmetrical. They all do different things.
Yeah.
There's kind of like a cool theme behind them. Yeah. Like, I had a company that made crappy shoes. So I just spat out huge amounts of goods, but my company, my goods didn't sell for much money, for example. So
yeah,
stuff like that's quite fun. It's not a terrible game, but... it doesn't get the stamp of approval.
Right.
It doesn't get the derailed stamp. They're not going to put a derailed stamp on their box. Yeah, so that's City of the Big Shoulders.
Yes.
Not an 18xx. Not a fantastic Euro.
No. I didn't mind it.
Yeah, it's okay. It's not terrible. Rudy, if you're listening, I'm sorry. It's his game. It's not terrible at all. It's really not bad. It's just not great.
Yeah.
I feel like these days I need... great.
Great, yes.
I've experienced greatness and I need it in my life. Yeah, so Fred, you had something that you wanted to talk about.
Yes, I wanted to ask you a little bit about strategy in the first stock round of, like, let's just keep it to full cap games maybe. So we've been playing 89 quite a bit.
Right.
So I've been trying to come up with, because the first stock round is a little bit different than the others. Firstly, the privates are sold kind of before it as part of it. So I think we can kind of consider that as part of the first stock round. The other thing is, I don't know if this is true for all 18xx's, but in 89, you can't sell shares in the first stock round.
I think it's true for most of them.
I think so. I think that should be fairly common. And the other thing that's interesting is after the first stock round, there is only one OR. Most likely after the second stock round, you'll have two ORs at least.
Right.
So I think the fact that there's one OR makes it interesting, because so what I've been thinking about, and tell me if this makes sense or not, or
I'm just completely off the
track here. But I've been thinking, like, maybe you should never ever buy shares in anyone else's company in the first stock round, because let's say you're trying to float whatever Erie, name a company, right? If I buy a share in that company, I'm effectively helping you to float it. So in 89, you need 60% to float, 50%. Right? 50% to float. Okay. So that means that you only need to buy 4 shares in Erie, because I've bought 1. But now that stock price is definitely going down, because there will only be 1 OR. So we're both losing. And now, because I bought a share, you're losing less than you would have if you had to float that company solo. So I've been really thinking, like, instead of buying a share in someone else's company in the first stock round is just never, ever do it. Don't help them float. After the first OR, then buy in.
What if hypothetically, and I don't think this would necessarily be a good strategy, but let's say you can't float your own company in the first round.
Mm.
Let's assume that, because there's usually one player who can't.
Right.
At least one player who can't, who doesn't have enough money to hit
50%. Yeah, depending on the privates. Yes.
Right. So what if you just passed until someone hit 50% of a company and then you started buying their shares?
Well, that share price is going to drop guaranteed because there's only one OR. So what's the difference? I'm not saying there isn't a difference. I just don't know. But instead of buying, okay, so let's say I can't float. You float a company. Now, I can buy a share now or I can wait till the next stock round and then buy a share. There's no difference to me. The cost is going to be the par value either way, right?
I guess it depends on two things, right? There's a scarcity of shares. So if everyone wants a piece of this company for some reason, then if you get in early, you can own like 40% of someone's company, for example, if you think it's going to be a really good company.
Right.
There's also the idea of action economy. Like if, let's say, you pass throughout the whole first stock round and then the next round you start buying up shares, there's a lot of actions that you potentially like miss out on.
What do you mean?
Well, if you take four actions in the first stock round and three actions in the next one, right, then let's say you've got seven actions that you want to do over two stock rounds. If you do zero in the first one and seven in the next one, you potentially don't get what you want to do. You also are going to be way off for priority in the third stock round. I think third stock round is actually a very important one.
Right, yeah.
So you run the risk of that as well.
So it's like an opportunity cost, basically.
I think that perhaps what we need to be doing maybe is better recognizing which companies are going to be very profitable and who we want to target. Because I think that there are company and private pairings in all of these games that you generally don't want someone to have.
Right.
So in 46, you don't want someone to float Grand Trunk and have all the Michigan crap that gives them all the free tiles and lets them build that east to west route incredibly quickly, and have the Michigan train company that lets you connect to that route and build extra tiles. I've heard that before and it's nuts. I don't think people should let you have that. I think if people see you buy those privates, see you owe them after the draft, they should float Grand Trunk so you can't.
Right, yeah.
I think you don't want to allow that to happen. Or if someone does do that, then I think you buy into Grand Trunk heavily. And then maybe in the second stock round, if you're willing to take a small hit to your capital, sell all of those shares to hurt that player and hurt that big advantage that they have. But the question of whether or not selling someone's shares hurts them is interesting, because it does then pay into the thing. So let's not talk 46, let's talk 89. It pays into the company.
Right.
So there's this idea that tanking someone's share price doesn't necessarily hurt them. I think that it hurts them early on because I think that first company, you want to sell it and buy more stuff. So I think if your shares are worth less than you paid for them, I think that does hurt you.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with all of that, but like, I still can't find a reason you can't just do that in the second stock round. Because if you float at 50%, you can only buy one more share in your own company anyway, right? So the only question is, will other people start buying up those shares? And if they do, then me selling one share of that in the second stock round hurts more people than just you.
So let's say, for example, in 89, I get the port company and the green company, which I think is a ridiculously good pairing.
Okay.
I've done it twice in a row and I won both those games. And I got insane dividends. I did that at both those games. Where you build the port in the bottom, the sort of like south middle of the board, sort of right where the green company is. And then your very first aura where you can run trains, you can run three routes if you get that combo. And that to me is pretty nuts. And very shortly after that, you can run four routes.
Yeah.
Because you can spark out of the green company towards the sort of northeast and get a fourth route that way. Yeah. So I did the same opening both times and I think it was nuts both times. If everybody knows that, then it's this thing where if you pass during the first stock round, someone else is going to be like, that's cool, I'll buy green.
Mm.
So that's where I think it becomes a metagame kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
Like, yeah, if no one else is aware that I have this very powerful combination, then sure, you can wait till the second stock round. But here's the thing. Even if people don't know, when in my very first aura, I'm like, cool, drop the port, drop the thing, buy 3-2 trains, done.
They'll see it.
Drop a station. They're like, oh, crap, this guy's about to run for like 150 or whatever.
Yeah.
In his first run, next stock round, you're not, let's say you are priority, you buy one, next person buys one, next person buys one, next person buys one. Everyone just wants a piece of green because they can see it's going to be mad dividends, right?
Yeah.
Let's say you bought four of them in the first stock round because you see that pairing.
Yes.
You're in a way better position. You rack up a bit of dividends. You sell it before I can. You tank my price. Mm. I don't get to float at a high price. So again, I think it becomes about this metagame kind of thing. Mm. And that changes as well, because if everyone sees that pairing, then in the first stock round, it's going to go one.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. But you still want a small piece of that anyway.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a good point. That's a good point.
So for me, I think a large part of buying into other people's companies in the first stock round is going to be dependent on recognizing which private and company combos are pretty insane. Mm. So just looking at someone's potential, let's say Rudy's over there and he floats the yellow company, to look at that and think, okay, let me think about how his first two ORs are going to go.
Mm.
What's his plan? How many dividends? Because you can, it's all open information, right?
Yes.
There's nothing hidden in 18xx. So you can figure all of that out.
Mm.
And you can figure out who has the best potential for early dividends and early stock jumps or whatever. And you say, cool, I'll invest in that. And then sell it off because that person is a threat. So you also, you get to neutralize a threat, but you also get to get some sweet dividends out of it as well.
Yeah.
And then you float your own company.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I just kind of think like in something like Rhineland where you have bonds, they might be a better buy in the first stock round.
Bonds,
but Cologne. Yeah, I meant Cologne. They might be a better buy in the first stock round and then sell them and then start buying shares in the second stock. But like you say, it depends whether other people are picking up on the potential of certain companies
and starting to buy shares. Yeah, when you get to Cologne, when they add something like bonds, it obviously changes the whole thing. Because bonds give a fairly good return on your investment.
Yeah.
Because each bond is basically like a share in a company that runs 400.
Yeah, it basically, and it runs the first OR effectively, which no one else can.
Yeah. So bonds are actually pretty legit. And I think bonds particularly have value, much higher value earlier on.
Definitely early, before the other companies can run better routes.
Overtake it, yeah.
Yeah.
They're also a safe buy in that no one can dump something on you, no one can tank your share price, no one can whatever. Mm. So you get better revenue, but you don't get the share jumps.
Yeah.
So you've got to balance that out as well because you don't get increased stock value.
Yeah.
But in the very first OR, no one gets increased stock value.
Yes, right? Exactly.
So that's where, buying. But then it becomes our opportunity cost. Do you really want to get into this person's company or do you want to get some bonds and stuff that makes sense to you. Yeah, so that's cool. That's just an extra niggle that they've added there that makes it more interesting.
Yeah.
But I think what's important is these, the private auction is, we are still not entirely, probably not even close, grasping the importance of that.
Mm.
You know, when we played that 1830 game online, the other two guys were playing, were like, wow, I've never seen a private auction go that quickly.
Yes.
We're like, this is how all our private auctions go. We're just like, I want that one. Cool, you can have that one. I'll take this one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I think like, for example, in our last 89 game, I got the mining company and the port company. And I think that's a very, very strong combination. The mining company gives good revenue and it pays for a lot.
Well, like, the mining company is the flattened
mountain. Is flattened the mountain ones,
right, yeah.
So you can buy it for quite a lot. You can buy it for like 100. It's cost like 60 or something. You can buy it for something like 120 or something like that, which is important because you can put that money directly back into your account or whatever.
Yes.
And that was kind of interesting because when I bought those two companies from myself, Simon was like, what are you doing? Like, I think he thought it was kind of like a bad move.
Because of the revenue.
Because of the revenue. Because he sees revenue as like, over the course of the game, I'm getting free money every round. Why would I want to give that up?
Right, yeah.
But by buying both those companies, I plugged like $200 into my personal cash.
Mm.
And in the next stock round, I managed to float a second company at 90 and only sell one share in my other company that was performing well.
Yes, yeah.
So that's like a pretty insane amount of revenue to have so early on, right?
Yeah.
But that's the thing. It's all about, not about how much revenue you can accumulate over time, but I can take that money now and turn it into much more than 15 revenue per OR or something.
Yes.
But that's something that Simon didn't get when he saw me do that, right?
Yeah.
But that just comes from not necessarily reading about 18xx or having experience. And because you read about this stuff and it's like the most important thing about privates is how much you can buy them for. I'm like, what? Why is that? And you're like, oh, right. And then you do it and you're like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
I have all this money. I floated this new company at a huge share price. I have all this money. I'm pushing the trains. Like, you take so much control over the game. Way more than 15 bucks per hour, which actually becomes like laughably irrelevant compared to what I was able to do with it.
Yes. Yeah.
But that combo is really good because the green company fits with the ports really well. And you can tunnel across some mountains in the other direction as well.
Yes. Yeah.
So you buy it into your company and then you start tunneling through the mountains and then you float a company that's on the other end of those mountains.
Yes.
And you know, so it's this really nice kind of setup. But I only really figured that out because we've been playing 89 again and again.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the more we play that, the more we're going to be aware of those kinds of things.
Yes.
So someone sees me bid on that port, then they're like, you're not getting it for cheap again.
It can't you know, it, yeah.
Or you're not, or the mining company and the port company, like, no, we're not letting you have both. Or you can have both, but I'm going first and I float green.
Right. Yeah.
You're gonna have to do something a little bit differently.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. That kind of stuff. So yeah. And green may not even be the best one. I don't know. I think it's the best one to float with the ports, but who knows? I think the port company is pretty legit. I really like it.
Yeah. But there must be other combos with other privates and
absolutely, and other corporations absolutely.
That we just haven't figured out yet.
No, definitely. But that's what's cool. I mean, that's part of the whole journey. But I think that this first stock round becomes more and more important the more you learn these different things.
Yeah.
We used to consider the privates almost like kind of like whatever.
Yes.
Like almost like an asymmetrical power, but like a really tiny, and irrelevant
just
one.
Like an obstacle before you get to floating companies, kind of.
Yeah.
Just have to get through this stage.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then you see some veteran be like, the private auction is the most important part of the game. We're like, what?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? You know? Yeah. Like, games can be lost in the private auction. What? How? What are you talking about? What should I be doing?
Yeah.
But I guess that's what makes the games great.
Yeah.
But I think there's a meta game to the first stock round that becomes very, very important.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess is really what I'm saying with that.
Yeah.
Where you recognize what is strong and you may want to attack it early.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah.
Or just not even attack it right away, but just buy into it, right? Benefit from it.
Yes. Yeah. Do you have any other tips for the private auction?
The private auction, I think that the one big tip, and I know it's very obvious, but I think if you're new, keep this in mind. Track how much you need at the end of the private auction to float a company. And if you can, try and not spend more than that.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, like in a four-player game of 89, I think you can spend 90 or 95 or something.
Well, you
like
need
that.
Five shares at the lowest you can borrow at 65. Is 65. So you need 5 times 65, which is what, 325? So you need to have 325 left after the private auction if you want to float something in the first stock round.
Yeah, which is 95.
Right.
It is 95. Yeah. Okay. So you can spend 95 because you start with 420.
Right.
Yeah. So you can spend 95 basically. So that's a good shortcut to have in your mind when you're doing the bidding and stuff like that. If you want to float a thing, keep it there, you know? Yeah. But also be thinking about when you're buying a private, I think just be thinking about what it is that you plan to do with it. And recognize that, yeah, being able to buy a private for double its value is arguably the most important part of it. So that private that costs 60 and only pays you revenue 10 or whatever, you might think, oh, that kind of sucks. It doesn't. Because you can suck 120 out of that treasury.
No, you're going to gain 60 from spending that 60.
Yeah, you can, because you can extract money from the treasury and that money doesn't belong to you. Half of that money belongs to the bank.
Yes.
So you get to suck that out. Yeah, so being able to extract money from your companies is one of the main advantages of private. So don't be afraid to sell them super early. Because in the next stock round, then you can go wild.
Yeah.
And then you start controlling the trains, you start controlling the capital flow of the game, and then you're in a very powerful position.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, man. First stock rounds.
Mm.
A lot to say about a first stock round.
They're becoming more important, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think it's interesting, this idea of helping someone else float their company. I mean,
I still think it might be, like you say, rather wait until they float it and then you start buying into it is better than helping them float it.
Yeah.
Mm.
I think if you know that you can't float a company and you know that going in, if you don't want to kind of attack someone else's thing, you can, for example, just chill. just pass, because you know you can pass freely until someone gets to 50% or whatever.
Yeah.
The stock round can be kind of scripted in the beginning because, yeah, people have set their money aside. As soon as they buy the president's share, they've committed to buying 50% of that company. Mm. For the most part, I don't know if that's going to change over time where someone only buys 30% and leaves it. I could see potentially doing that and being worth it if you really want to block a company from someone.
You can do that if you want to avoid someone else parring a company high and getting a lot of money into the treasury. You par it low, don't float it, and then you don't really lose value on the stock. It's not gaining you anything either, but it's not falling if it's not floated. So
yeah.
But then other people can start floating it for you as well again. So yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting as well. Like, I mean, I wonder if there's something to say for that. If, for example, let's say Green and the port is a really powerful combination.
Mm.
You buy the president's share of Green, right? To block it from someone else. Mm. But you can only buy 3 shares and that person can buy 4. So they can take it over from you.
Right, yeah.
But at the end of all of that, you end up in a situation where they have 4 shares and you have 3.
Mm.
The next stock round, maybe you have enough money to buy another share. Probably not though, actually. But they won't either. The next stock round, people have very little extra income. Actually, they just have whatever their privates gave them.
Yeah.
But the stock round after that, they buy up to 50, you buy up to 40. You know what I mean? You can be pretty close to them. And then if you time it correctly, you can dump it before they can. You get to collect some dividends. So,
or you can be 50-50 even.
Yeah. Mm. So it potentially puts you in a more powerful position.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if you wait for them to buy presents and then you start buying, then they just stop buying and they sort of go off of what you're doing and you don't get to control that as much.
Yes. Yeah.
Or they just leave you with the 30% and float something else.
Yeah.
Which is potentially pretty bad for you because it can take a long time then for you to get enough money to actually buy your 4th and 5th share.
Yeah, because your money's kind of stuck.
Very
stuck. I don't think you can't sell shares before a company's floated either, right?
Oh, before it's operated. I think oftentimes you can't sell a company's shares before it's operated.
So in 89, I'm specifically thinking about, I think you can sell before it's operated, but you can't sell before it's floated because there's no marker in the open markets, basically.
Yeah.
That can move down until it's floated.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Hey, yeah, I think you're right about that. That does make sense. Yeah. We haven't had anyone try it, so we haven't had to check yet, but that does make sense.
Yeah,
so I don't think you could potentially float something just to block it unless you have enough money to actually float it yourself. If you're the guy who can only afford 3 shares, you don't want to buy the president's shares of Green because you don't want someone else to have Green because it's going to be a long time before you can float.
Well, unless you can't avoid them getting Green anyway, then you can just par it low so that they have less capital.
Yeah, but first stock round, everyone's going to be parring at 65 pretty much.
Yeah.
Maybe 70, but not enough to make a meaningful difference.
Yeah. No, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you can do blocking stuff later on, but in the beginning, you definitely don't want to do that. Not in the first one. Unless you can afford to float it yourself, you don't want to get stuck with 3 shares you can't sell because it's going to take you forever.
Yeah.
Because you're not getting dividends from anyone's company.
Yeah, so that money is stuck in those shares. You can't do
It'll be a game-losing play, so don't do that.
Yeah.
And that runs the risk then if you try that gambit of someone just saying, cool, I'll float something else and leaving you with that.
So I
think if you can't afford to float it yourself, don't do it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now that I think about that one, that person could leave you in a very tough spot. Yeah, so maybe don't do that.
Yeah.
But certainly don't be afraid to buy into if you see a really, really good company and you can see its potential. I think it's fine if you help them float it. If you're the first one to get out, then it's cool.
Yeah, I feel like I've been kind of like when I started playing 18xx, I was just buying shares in good companies. And then I got very wary of getting companies dumped on me. So now I'm kind of very hesitant to buy too many shares, even in good companies. And now I'm kind of slowly moving towards kind of being able to tell when someone would want to dump something. And I think there are times when it's safe, where it's pretty clear that someone is making money from a company and they don't want to get rid of it. And then it's safe to buy lots of shares in that company again. So.
And if you just want to invest in someone and you're not really sure who's got the best company, invest in the player to your left.
Yes. Yeah.
The reason for that is you can always control whether or not that person acts before you in the next stock round.
Right. Yeah.
Basically, as long as you are not the last person to act, you can control it a lot better anyway in terms of because if they're the last person to act, then you'll be fine. If you're the last person to act, you give them priority deal. That's a bit of a scrub. But if the person after them, for example, is the last person to act, then you still get to act before them.
Right, yeah.
So you can control whether or not you're going to act before them or not, just by making sure that you're not the last person to act, basically. Yes.
And that gives you time to sell shares if it does look like they might be wanting to get rid
of that. Yeah, you can't get something dumped on you. So they can't do those shenanigans where they have two companies and you see them like selling trains and you're like, oh God, this is on me.
Yeah.
They can't do that to you, because as soon as you see them do that, you act before them in the stock round, you get to dump it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's basically, as long as they're not priority, you'll act before them. Is that correct? I feel like that is.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So that means that you can literally control it.
Yeah.
As long as you are not the last person to act, you will not be screwed over.
Yes. Yeah.
You can't control a lot in terms of priority deal. You don't always have total control, but investing in the player to your left does give you that control.
Yeah.
So if you're scared, just do that and hope that they're not a terrible CEO.
Yeah, they pay some dividends.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah, that's cool, man. I don't know if there's anything else you feel like we've left out or any thoughts you want to add to that.
No, I think I learned something. I need to pick your brain so that I can start being more competitive in these games.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I like when you said, like, I'm going to ask you, I was like, oh God, I don't know anything. I don't know. But and I think the more you talk about it, the more you kind of break it down and stuff.
Yeah.
And you kind of work through some ideas. And what do you think works and what doesn't? And
so
this is just the stuff I've been thinking about. Yeah. But
no, that's good.
Yeah, certainly not necessarily the be all and end all. So,
all right.
Yeah, explore. use this advice at your own risk.
Yes. Yeah.
What I say. And if you discover something, or let us know. Mm, we're very open to anyone emailing us and giving us tips or your experiences or something. If we say something dumb, then please correct us. Yeah. We love to learn. So. Yeah. It's all about learning, and then we can pass on that learning to the people who listen as well.
Yeah.
And from the emails, a lot of people listening to this podcast are very new to 18xx.
Yeah.
Which is cool. I feel like there's a boom. There's an 18xx boom happening.
Feels like it, yeah.
I think we got swept up in that boom, and that's why we wanted to do this podcast in the first place, because we just felt like it's a growing thing, man. People are getting into it, and
yeah.
I know whenever I get into something new, I look for a podcast about it. That's how I roll.
Yeah,
man. Are we on South African stuff?
Yes, let's go to South African stuff.
Yeah, so we don't know how much we've maybe spoken about this in the past, but we were going to talk about South African food a little bit.
Mm.
South African food is pretty diverse, though. Kind of for all the wrong reasons. South Africa was, we spoke about this before, sort of in the center of the trade route, the Dutch East India Company, part of their spice route or whatever. And we had a bunch of natural resources, diamonds, coal, gold, all that kind of stuff is all here. So we've had a lot of like laborers brought here and a lot of just straight up slaves brought here in a much worse time. So because of that, we've got a lot of different influences. So there's sort of what they call Cape Malay food. And those are, that's due to the slave trade. So that's people from like Malaysia, Nepal, that side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of mixed with a bit of South African flavor. So there's that whole Cape Malay stuff. There's Cape Dutch, which is the Dutch settlers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Fred, what would you, are you, I'm going to put you on the spot. What is a Cape Malay dish?
I was hoping you'd tell me.
I thought you might be. It's funny because we know these terms and we talk about them a lot. No, we don't talk about them a lot, but you would have heard that expression before.
Yes.
And it's kind of this like, you're like, yeah, it's those like curries and stuff that aren't really Indian curries. You know what I mean? It's like that like nebulous kind of, sort of vague. I think like babuti and stuff like that kind of falls into that kind of category. Babuti is like a weird sort of curried mince.
I'm not a fan because of the raisins.
I like the raisins. Babuti, I don't like raisins without raisins.
Yeah, it's like rice and mince and raisins and I don't know, maybe some carrots.
Yeah,
or
it's got like curried
things.
Mince and raisins.
Yeah,
the raisins is an essential part. Mixed with that kind of like yellow rice, and it's almost like baked with like a crispy top,
like a cheese topping almost.
Yeah,
like a crispy cheese.
It's like a crumb almost.
Yeah,
like
it could be like a breadcrumbs.
Yeah, I think it's like a breadcrumb kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's that kind of stuff. There's a lot. We've got a huge Chinese population, which I think at this point everyone in the world does. So there's a lot of immigrating from China to all different areas. So, but yeah, we've got that, but we've also got a lot of Indian people living here. So we've got a huge amount of Indian food. I think
the most South African of those is probably bunny chow.
Yeah, bunny chow. Is that a thing like in India, or is that like a South African thing?
It's a South African thing.
No, okay.
So the reason, bunny chow, from my understanding, I could be wrong here, but I'm pretty sure this is where it originated. It originated in Durban. So bunny chow is basically a hollowed out loaf of bread or half loaf of bread filled with like a curry, right?
Yeah, just filled with curry, basically.
So yeah, it's this hollowed out bread. So my understanding is the reason they started selling those is because people who were like the laborers and things couldn't go sit down at a restaurant at lunchtime, or they couldn't buy a meal with like, you know, cutlery or something like that. So the bunny chow was kind of created to give them like a self-contained, here's a container with the meal and everything, you know, no cutlery or plates or anything necessary. So
that's cool, man.
Yeah,
I didn't know that, but that makes sense. And it's amazing. It's so good.
It is. Yeah,
you've never eaten curry out of a hollowed out loaf of bread. You are missing out. Yeah, really, really good. So that was just the gold rush, diamond rush, all that stuff. So they brought in thousands and thousands of Indian laborers, basically.
Right.
So people to work on the mines. I don't think that was slavery. I think they were paid, but probably not treated very well. So probably not great. But as a result, we have a massive Indian population on, and like Fred says, Durban especially. For some reason, but it is a coastal town.
Well, it's
coastal town. Yeah, but that seems to be the Indian epicenter of South Africa. But it's a very sort of we said this before, but a very cosmopolitan mix of people. And then we have all the traditional sort of indigenous African foods. Sort of the like kind of Bantu tribes and stuff all moved down to South Africa at some point. I don't know when exactly all that migration and stuff happened. But yeah, there's all of that cuisine that kind of comes with that as well. Yeah, so lots of different food. I think some of our iconic ones, Fred, you'll know all about poikikos.
Yes.
That's an Afrikaans word. Does it just mean like pot food, basically? Like small pot food?
Yes.
Basically, is how you directly translate that.
Right, yeah.
But that's really cool. I think it's like, is it like cast iron or like pewter?
It's like a cast iron three-legged pot.
Yeah.
That you can put directly onto coals on a fire, basically. You can just make a fire on the ground, have coals, and put this pot on top of it.
Basically, imagine like a really tiny cauldron.
Yes. Yeah.
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 And that's really cool because you just basically fill it with vegetables and meat and all this stuff.
And potatoes just, and...
Yeah.
And yeah, and you cook it for a long time as well.
Hours and hours. Yeah.
So it's like really tenderizes everything cooking.
It's amazing, actually. It's really, really good. But I think it's part of a lot of our food cultures based around like kind of social interaction. So poiki is something that, you'll set up and people just sit around and drink and chat and whatever for the whole day. And
like a lazy Sunday kind of
thing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You get that thing going before people arrive, and it's this whole day long kind of thing, right?
Yes.
Yeah, very, very cool. A braai is sort of similar to that. Basically what Americans would call a barbecue or whatever.
But different.
A little bit different, yeah. A little bit less structured, perhaps.
I think the kind of things you make on a braai is also, like, we have a lot of steak and what we call boerewors, which is basically sausage, but it's not like, I don't know, Vienna sausage or something.
Yeah.
It's
basically like a spiced sausage. Usually
and,
beef based.
And thicker as well, usually.
Although comes you get in a coil.
Yeah, it comes in a coil. Yeah, so a braai is also a very social thing as well.
Very much so, yeah.
And we've got pop as well.
Oh, yeah.
Millie pop, which comes from... So maize is our biggest, what is it, a staple food, I think you call it.
Yeah.
Millies or maize. So yeah, pop is basically ground down maize. You get this, I guess it's a powder, but...
It basically is almost like a powder, but it's quite like rough. It's quite coarse. It's basically just like...
Yeah, but there's a better word. Anyway. So, and you add water to that and it thickens it and cook that slowly.
Just like a huge amount of starch, basically.
Yes, it is. But the interesting thing about pop is that you can do different consistencies. Like you can have what we call slop pop, which is kind of like runny porridge almost. And then you can go slightly firmer, and then you can go all the way up to Krimmel pop, which basically means crumbed pop, is kind of like little, it starts separating into little grains.
And you can always have it as like a dessert as well. If you have like a mealy meal and you pour like milk and sugar into it and stuff. And then
used to have that for breakfast as a kid.
Like a breakfast
pop thing. And milk, which is pop and milk.
It's like a very, very sweet, but Afrikaans food is often very sweet, actually.
It is, a lot of it is sweet,
But it's so badass, guys. Like, it tastes so good. Like, they'll make like a pumpkin or whatever, and they just pour like mountains of sugar into it. It will literally kill you, but it all tastes so amazing. Like, their vegetables are not healthy.
Yes.
Yeah. The like Afrikaans style like veggies and stuff is just straight up like just like sugar,
but
and, like,
very good,
cinnamon
yeah.
and cream and whatever like poured in there. But it's amazing. It's
and
so good.
Then we've got some desserts. We've got milk.
Milk tart
in Afrikaans, which is basically a kind of like a, it's a dessert Turkish tart, or you can have it with tea as well, afternoon tea, made from milk. So it's also a sweetener and a bit of a crust. And then we've got Kuksustash. How would you describe Kuksustash?
It's basic. It's almost like a donut, but it's very firm, right? So it's like deep fried. It's basically like syrup. I don't know. It's almost like if you could turn syrup hard. It feels a bit like that.
Yeah, so it is kind of like a dough, but it's kind of weaved.
It's crunchy. Yeah, it's braided.
Yes, braided. But hard, yeah. Like a hard one and then coated in syrupy.
Yeah, so when you bite into it, it's basically full of like runny syrup.
Yes.
Like sugary syrup, yeah. Very sweet.
Very sweet.
Very nice though.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I can normally only have one or two because it's too sweet.
No, it's pretty delicious though.
And then we have Biltong and Drewoosh.
Yes.
So that's the thing that people usually compare it to is
beef jerky.
Although biltong doesn't have to be made from beef. It can be kuru or impala or any kind of game. And it's also thicker usually than jerky. Jerky is very thin and dry and easy to snap, whereas I like my biltong a little bit more wet.
Yeah.
And Drewoosh is similar, except it's kind of like a thin sausage almost, also that you hang and dry. And I think the reason those were created was it was a good way for the voortrekkers back in the day to transport food when journeying over long distances. They didn't have fridges or anything. So they would stop for a hunt every now and then, dry the meat, and then you're able to take that with you. It lasts for a long time.
And it's amazing.
It is.
I don't want to throw shade, but it's significantly better than beef jerky.
Oh, yeah.
I've been to America, guys, and you need to get on the Biltong train. I'm telling you. Yeah, I don't know what they do differently. I mean, it is oftentimes a lot wetter.
Yes.
So it's much closer almost to raw meat than like totally dried out.
Well, yeah. So traditionally, it's made in winter in South Africa. Mm. I guess it depends where in South Africa you are as well. But like up in Joburg, summer is our rainfall season, so winter is usually dry and cold. So it's pretty easy to dry this meat without it going bad because the air is dry as well.
Right.
So you don't get the moisture. Whereas if you're in a moist, like a high humidity environment, it's much more difficult to make it.
Yeah, it's good. It's really, really good. Yeah, sure. And then we have so many strange foods there. I'm thinking of like so we have a lot of townships, which is what we kind of call the like informal settlements, the much poorer sort of areas of the country. And they kind of have their own like brands of food, which is kind of cool. So like, I don't know if you know what a quarter is.
No.
So a quarter, and it's funny because it's basically, it's like quarter, like 1/4 quarter, but it's said with almost like an African accent. So it's actually generally spelled like Q-U-O-T-A, like quarter.
Okay.
Rather than, but the origin is literally just quarter.
Right, yeah.
Right? But it's like a quarter loaf of bread that's kind of cut in half. And then you pile like chips and like deep fried Vienna sausages and stuff.
I've seen it, yes.
Yeah. So there's a lot of like sort of little informal kind of food stalls and stuff like that set up where they sell this kind of stuff. And they sell it on the side of the road sometimes. They set up shop. All that kind of stuff. So yeah, a lot of stuff that may not be so palatable to a lot of people. A lot of like brains. Chicken feet is a big South African thing.
Mm.
And then, yeah, a lot of like organ stuff. Yes.
Yeah.
Chicken liver is very popular in South Africa.
Oh, yes.
And that's popular with everyone, though. Everyone loves chicken liver. It's a big thing. You'll see it at every restaurant you go to as a starter, usually. It's very, very common.
Everywhere, yeah.
Often done with like a spicy kind of sauce and stuff. I don't know how common that is overseas. I don't know if it's a thing.
I don't know, actually.
Yeah, but chicken liver is very big here.
Mm.
I mean, usually served with bread and often quite spicy as well.
Yeah.
So stuff like that is really, really cool. Mm. I love stuff like that because it's actually delicious, like super cheap.
Yeah.
I don't know about the food safety standards and stuff like that, but
no, I think it's pretty safe.
I think it's good. I don't know if it'll pass the like rigid testing, but whatever, it tastes good. Yeah. So that's African food, man. Sorry, I think we talked about that for quite a while, but you know, this stuff comes at the end, so you can always chew down before it, I guess. But yeah, so many different influences. I left out obviously the British influence, a lot of British settlers, so a lot of traditional British food like Sunday roasts, kind of stuff is very common. A lot of restaurants have that as well. So a lot of that traditional British sort of cuisine and culture, even French cooking. Some of the French refugees were down here, so we've got a lot of French influence in some of our cooking as well. So Yeah, really.
Yeah, it's from all over. Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff that's quite cool because it's sort of like it has influences from other countries, but it's now become like uniquely South African.
Yes.
Stuff like the milk tart, the Cook sisters, the poiki.
Mm.
Yeah, a lot of that Afrikaans stuff is very uniquely South African. Mm. And yeah, obviously a lot of the traditional African stuff is very much
yes.
South African. Yeah, mm. So very, very cool.
Yeah, it is.
Our food's good, though, actually. Our restaurants are pretty good as well.
Yes.
We always recommend people coming on holiday because your money will go so far. If you're coming with euros, dollars, pounds, you'll be richer.
Mm.
Our currency sucks.
Especially for eating out.
Yeah. Yeah, our currency sucks and eating out is pretty cheap. So accommodation is cheap.
Mm.
So, yeah, definitely if you ever think about coming to a different place for holiday, you will have a good time in South Africa. It's a very, very beautiful country. There's lots of stuff to do. There's lots of places to eat, things to buy, all that kind of jazz. There's a lot of very like first world parts of it, I guess I would say.
Yeah,
it's maybe not so nice, but we have a pretty huge divide between the rich and the poor in this country. I think it's actually the biggest in the world. We have the biggest gap.
Oh, really?
In that sense, yeah. So don't let the crime stats and stuff put you off. Generally, if you stay in the right places,
and let us know, and we'll play an 18 exit.
Yes, if you listen to this podcast, definitely let us know. You can sleep in my spare room. We'll play an 18XX. I'll tell my wife that someone I met on the internet is coming to stay in a house for a few days.
Some stranger, but it's okay. They like train games.
Yeah, they like train games. So they're safe. They're good. No stress. But yeah, no, seriously, if anyone is ever this side, we're in Johannesburg, which is where you'll probably land. So, you know. You could be
it's
here.
Where the big airport is.
Yeah, it's where the big airport is.
Mm.
Yeah, and a cool place to visit. Cape Town's probably our most famous touristy kind of place to go.
Yes.
Yeah, but there's a lot of beautiful parts of the country. It's definitely worth exploring. Rent a car, drive all over. Awesome.
Yeah.
Your money will go super far and you'll have a good time.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's my tourism pitch. My diplomacy is done. Cool. But thanks, everyone, for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I had fun this episode. I had fun talking about stock rounds and Cook sisters. So, yeah, thanks very much, guys, and have a great weekend, probably by the time you hear this.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Enjoy. Thanks a lot.
Cheers.
Cheers.